Think about horses in popular culture, and your attention is likely to fall first on the image of the cowboy, which is understandable given the durability of our interest in the Old West. Two things. First of all, a cowboy is a man on a horse. Second of all, there's a whole other place to put your attention on horses and people in popular culture, and that's on females. Think Black Beauty and My Little Pony, and there's an ongoing and strong appeal about horses for young females. Our guest this hour knows what that feels like and writes about it in the book Horse Crazy. It is subtitled Girls and the Lives of Horses. It's the work of Jean O'Malley Holly, who's a sociology professor at the College of Staten Island and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. She's the author or co-author of several previous books, including The Parallel Lives of Women and Cows, Meat Markets. Jean O'Malley Holly, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here.
So you grew up in horse country loving horses yourself, from the sounds of it.
I absolutely did. I was utterly, utterly horse crazy. And like one of the women I spoke with, I look back and think, when did that whole thing start? And it seems like I was born and then looked around for horses. I've always felt this way, it seems. I was lucky enough to live in a rural area in Wyoming and Montana, where I was able to, for, you know, really very little money, have a horse. So I grew up riding a lot, spending a lot of time on and around horses.
And Jean, how critical was loving horses to getting you through your childhood?
Well, I had a difficult childhood. There was a lot of alcoholism and some violence in my family, and so the horses really literally carried me through. I feel like I was sort of, to some extent, raised by them. I gained strength and confidence, a place where I belonged, a sense of safety, close relationship with my horse. It was profoundly life-altering for me, really.
So this was certainly there in your own makeup, but then as a sociologist, you studied other people's reactions to things in society. Did it just take you a while to get back around to horses as a book?
It did. I have studied, focused mostly on race, class, gender issues, and what happened was I had a daughter, and my daughter became horse crazy, and I was so surprised. I mean, I guess I hadn't, I lived in a very rural area, and for me, my horse craziness happened very individually. I was sort of on my own with my horse. So I wasn't quite prepared for the fact that this seems to be a widespread phenomenon. And I was really surprised when I realized that, a lot of girls feel today and in the past felt like I did as a girl. So I began to kind of look around for scholarly literature on it and found that there was really nothing on horse crazy girls in the scholarly literature. And so I thought, wow, what is that phenomena about? Why do girls, not all, but some, become so passionate about horses, girls like me, girls like my daughter, and then I decided it would be a really interesting thing to study. So I picked it up several years ago and have just had such a great experience, speaking with lots and lots of women and girls who feel and felt like I did.
So let's set out some contrasts up front, though, because this helps understand things. I mean, for example, girls and cats or girls and dogs are not so much of a consumer thing the way that girls and horses are.
Exactly. And that was interesting to me because I, as a child, was, and I continue to be, a real animal lover. But the way consumer culture has responded to girls and animal, being animal people and animal girls, has really been a focus on the horses. And so I kind of thought, well, that says something about our society, that consumer culture has really focused on horse crazy girls. But I think it also says something about the phenomena that girls don't necessarily become passionate about other species the way they do, some girls, about horses. And the kind of passion is really interesting. I mean, when a girl is horse crazy, there's obviously variation, but in general, she becomes really obsessed with horses, draws them, thinks about them, fantasizes, reads, tries to be around them if it's at all possible, spends any free time she can with horses, pretends to be a horse. I mean, it just is very all-consuming. And that, I don't think, happens in the same way for girls with other animals, although, I think, like me, I think a lot of girls really love a lot of animals. And I think horse-crazy girls do tend to be, animal people. But the passion for horses seems to be somewhat unique.
There's an interesting line you draw here, too, Jean, because you're saying you're not talking about girls who ride competitively, for example.
Exactly. So people, humans and girls in particular, have a lot of ways of spending time with horses. And I think, it's an amazing sport. And certainly pleasure riders, it's a sport for them, too. I mean, riding is like hiking or other sports, something that takes skill and athleticism, for sure. But I didn't want to focus on competitive riders for a variety of reasons, primarily because it's a very expensive sport, and so I thought it would take me away from the sort of mainstream girls that were like me, girls who didn't necessarily have much, or in our case, very little money, and what the horses meant to them. I thought that the sport part is super interesting, and that actually has been explored a little more. People have studied horseback riding as a sport, and that's amazing, but this was, I wanted to see what the relationship and the obsession was about. And so, yeah, I actually, you know, focused on girls who were mostly working class, middle class, some like me. We were, you know, for a number of years, really poor, and what horses meant to them in a more all-encompassing way. So not just as an athlete, but also as a relationship, as an obsession.
You know, it's funny. I read the first little bit of the book and then went home for the day. And on the way home, I got behind a car that had two bumper stickers. One said, "Horses are proof God loves us." The other one said, "Horses are my therapy." Now, the therapy part is a proven benefit of human-horse relations, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. And it's becoming more and more recognized. It's really interesting how horses have become, like that bumper sticker said, therapists. And what's fascinating about it to me, or one piece of what's fascinating, is that horses are used in therapy with a whole range of issues and disorders and disabilities. You know, a lot of therapy, it focuses on one kind of issue, right? Like, you know, if somebody has a particular psychiatric disability, perhaps post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, there are kinds of talk therapy that focus on that. But horses are used for post-traumatic stress disorder, people who have autism, people who have no psychiatric issues. You know, they use a wheelchair and they want help with mobility. I mean, horses are used in therapy for a whole range of things. And that's kind of amazing. You know, it makes one wonder, so what exactly is going on that they become so healing? And I think the answer to that question is a piece of why girls become so obsessed with them.
And you know, now that it occurs to me, Jean, I probably need to mention at this point, we're not being you know, judgmental or anything here. I mean, the fact is that boys simply don't take to horses in the same way that girls do. Is that right?
Yeah, that seems to be the case, and I don't know exactly why. It certainly hasn't always been that way. I mean, once horses in the United States and other places were really associated with men. You know, they were used in the 1800s and early 20th century as transportation, as, you know, farm. They did agricultural labor. They did all kinds of work for humans to help humans sustain life. And so because the areas where they worked tended to be associated with men, horses were also associated with men. What happened was, as the United States, and this was similar in other places, industrialized and we began to use cars and machinery and have factories to produce what we needed, you know, machinery for farms, horses were used less and less for that kind of productive labor. And as that shifted, then it sort of opened up a space where girls and women rushed in. I think that there were still a lot of boys that were horse crazy well into the middle of the 20th century, but it sort of tapered off. And I think a piece of why has to do with boys going into horse worlds and seeing, oh my goodness, this is all girls. And I think boys in our culture feel a lot of pressure to differentiate themselves from girls and not be like girls. And so that's, you know, some of why maybe boys that would have been horse crazy don't end up, you know, being passionate in the same way about horses. And this, of course, you know, there's always exceptions, but as a general rule, it's a world that seems to be pretty dominated by girls and then later by women.
So yeah. Let's come to the center of the relationship then, because a horse crazy girl, as you point out, gets to be a bit different from the rest of the girls.
That's right. I found that, now this is again, you know, this was not true of all of the women I spoke with or the girls that I spoke with, but a lot had been marginalized in some way in their communities. Like maybe they were LGBTQ, or maybe they had a disability, or they were just kind of, you know, awkward or shy or had trouble making friends. And those girls, I think, were more largely represented among the horse crazy girl population. I think it became a place where they fit, where they belonged, where they found community. And for some, like me, I mean, I, you know, had a really troubled family life. For me, it was, you know, the place that I felt safe and strong and gained confidence. And in my case, I was pretty much alone with my horse because I lived in a very rural area and, you know, there wasn't the same sort of stable culture there can be in other places. A lot of the women I spoke with who had been horse crazy were part of a stable community, which in a more urban area is, I think, how it tends to happen more. And that is, horse crazy girls kind of find a stable somewhere they can get to, you know, outside of Boston or New York or somewhere in Connecticut, and they just go and they hang out. And maybe they can't afford lessons because lessons are really expensive, and they can't afford to have their own horse because, you know, in urban areas, that's super expensive. But what they can do is just spend time around the stable. And so a lot of girls end up kind of, you know, becoming a part of the stable community and hanging out with a lesson horse, maybe helping out, giving the horse love. And slowly, in exchange for what ends up being really valuable work they do, often stables will end up giving them lessons for free. So they kind of work their way into the community. And in those communities of stables, that tends to be more groups of girls. So I spoke with women who said, you know, their best friends were other girls at the stable, and they were all horse crazy together. So it wasn't, it was a piece of it was the all-girlness of it that I think brought safety. And then the other piece, perhaps the piece that I focused on at any rate, was the relationship with the horse, you know, this animal in itself.
Jean O'Malley-Holly, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Horse Crazy, Girls and the Lives of Horses. Here's a call from Anne in Eugene. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you. I spent my first 11 years on a dirt farm in northwestern Missouri. I had my first ride at the age of 5, and at 77, at the end of this program, I'll be going to the stable to ride. So I've had a long relationship with horses. And as you notice, little girls are told, don't get in strangers' cars. Don't go certain places after dark. Don't go certain places alone. And horses are also prey animals. So my theory is that women and horses are both prey animals. And that's the basis of our relationship, because we understand what it's like to be a prey animal. Thank you.
All right. So a sense of shared protection for each other or something. Jean, what do you make of that?
I think that was a really insightful and very interesting comment. And I said something kind of similar in my book, and that is, so I'm not sure, you know, hopefully I'm understanding the caller's very interesting ideas correctly. I discussed something that I've looked a lot at in my other research, and that is how much violence against women and girls there is in our society. I mean, some people call the U.S. a rape culture because rape rates are so high here, you know, different from other places in the world. And I thought about how that fear that we do, as the caller said, you know, we teach our daughters to be careful, don't go out at this hour, don't wear that. You know, girls sort of grow up knowing they have to be watching out to avoid violence against them. And even then, obviously, sometimes, it still happens. They can't control the world enough to stop it all the time. So I agree that I think girls and women are sort of raised to feel somewhat afraid. And with horses, they feel safer and stronger. And literally, I mean, when you become adept on riding a horse, you are bigger and stronger and faster. For me, I definitely felt my safest when I was with and on my horse. The funny irony of it is that horses as a sport, you know, whether you're a pleasure rider or a competitive rider, it is a very dangerous sport. Technically or statistically speaking, the rates of injury are high, and the types of injury can be very, you know, devastating. And so some sports scholars argue it's the most dangerous sport. I don't know. You know, we could debate about that. But at any rate, it's up there as a dangerous sport. So it's really interesting that girls, who are in some ways the more vulnerable members of our society, feel safest and strongest when they're doing a sport that's ostensibly dangerous. It's kind of neat. You know, it really offers a challenge to ways we think about girls.
And this really drops us at the front step of the three ways that you list in which girls with horses break out of the grip of normalization. And one is self-assertion. I mean, what do horse-loving women tell you about feel like being something more when they're around horses?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I found that also to be, you know, really interesting, that girls with horses in some ways reproduce the demands made of them in our culture. Like, girls are supposed to be caregiving and take care of and be loving to animals and other creatures, along with children, other, you know, babies. They're raised to have dolls and take care of babies. That sort of way in which our culture shapes girls, they get to act out with horses. They do, you know, horse crazy girls do a lot of caregiving. They spend a lot of time, and some who, you know, don't ever manage to get access to lessons end up spending a lot of time just caring for horses that somebody lets them hang around. So that, you know, they do kind of take up that part of our culture. But at the same time, as you just pointed out, they also self-assert. So horseback riding isn't about just kind of caregiving in the background. It's also about, you know, being strong and brave and able to handle this enormous, over 1,000 pounds animal, right, and risk injury. I mean, there's so many ways in which I think horse crazy girls are extraordinarily brave. You know, again and again, the women I spoke with talked about accidents they'd had in childhood and how, you know, with a leg broken in several places, they still got back on the horse, you know. that's what we're taught to do, and they did. And so there is a self-assertion and a kind of strength and courage, I think, that comes out of the horse craziness for girls.
So self-assertion, the first of the three ways in which girls break out of the grip of normalization. Number two is the body connection, essentially being one with the horse. How different is that from norms?
I think, yeah, no, I love that you're bringing these three up. It's really interesting for me. Yeah, I think that girls in our culture, in the mainstream at any rate, there's a demand that they be very thin, and to some extent with that, frail, not tough or strong or, you know, things that are understood to be masculine. They're meant to be in need of help. They, you know, they're not, we have the doors held open for us, right? All of that sort of points to an understanding of girls and women as less able physically. And yet with a horse, they become much more able. In fact, riding is a sport where your goal is, pleasure riding or the more competitive type, your goal is to be one with the horse. And so you're literally becoming, in some sense, a whole other animal, right? You were a girl and that was a horse, but now you're a girl horse together. And you work to interact with the horse in a way that no one outside can see. You're basically having a whole conversation with the horse such that it looks like the two of you are seamless. It looks like you're just one creature. And that's, you know, so what a creature, right? To go from being somebody who's at risk for violence and who's, you know, supposed to be thin and concerned about appearance to being enormous and strong and able to run very fast and, you know, all these things that challenge those sort of normal or normative ways of understanding girl bodies.
And the third challenge to normalization from the girl-horse relationship, you say, is the alternative to boy relationships. It's a very different power dynamic with girl and horse.
That's right. That is, and that's in some ways, I mean, I think is really fascinating that horse crazy girls do tend to be horse crazy instead of boy crazy. Now that's, you know, it's obviously a range and so on, but in general, a girl who's passionate about horses is putting her time and energy and attention into horses instead of, you know, dreaming about boys and someone rescuing or getting married or those more normative fantasies. You know, I was amazed in my daughter's generation, she's now 13, but how much the whole princess thing is still very prominent in our culture, that girls be princesses, that they look like princesses, that they, you know, act like princesses, delicate and waiting for someone to rescue. Well, horse craziness is really not that at all. In fact, one of the women I spoke with said, you know, I just wasn't a princess. I was really interested in horses. And she said, even my fantasies, the games I played, were about me being on a horse going to rescue someone, or me being on a horse being brave and running fast. Or, you know, it's a whole other set of fantasies that challenge that kind of heteronormative or heterosexual demand that girls make their lives around romantic relationships with boys.
Jean O'Malley Holly, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Horse Crazy, Girls and the Lives of Horses. Jean, a sociologist in New York City. You can join the conversation here on the Exchange as we talk about horse craziness. Share a story, as Jean already did. She's off to the stable, she says, as soon as the program is over. Thank you, Jean. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I meant thank you, Anne, but thank you, Jean, for being here. So we're talking about the princess thing, which kind of gets us into the zone of My Little Pony, because this character or series of characters comes up in the book a lot. For the people who don't know My Little Pony, this is sort of like Barbie dolls with horses or something, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, My Little Pony is, I think, you know, we live in a consumer culture, and so businesses will try to find ways to make money. That's how our culture works. And one of the ways to make money is to kind of pick up on passions that exist out there in the culture and use them to sell stuff. And so I think, you know, the horse craziness became a really great way for certain industries to make a lot of money. So My Little Pony is a highly successful example, where there's television shows and movies and just a plethora of stuff that girls can buy and their parents can buy for them. And it's an interesting, I mean, a lot of the material that was available to me when I was a girl in the 70s was more, it represented horses a little more closely. I mean, the horses actually look like horses. They were made by this company, Breyer, and they were, you know, sort of beautiful plastic pieces, and a lot of Horse Crazy Girls had at least a couple. My Little Pony came a little after my childhood, and it was more of a princess or a Barbie doll, as you said, version of ponies. So the ponies are in very non-pony colors. They're pink and purple and colors like that. And with My Little Pony, there's a lot of focus on sort of normative girlness, right? Trying to be pretty and getting, you know, trying to be beautiful, sort of things that girls are, you know, meant to be in the normative culture. Yet it does, I don't think it's just that. I found it to be interesting that it also offered a challenge to some of the norms. For example, at least some of the generations of My Little Pony, I mean, there's been several waves of them. One, I think the third generation in particular, really focuses on the ponies having friends with other ponies, and so girl friendships. Most of the ponies are girls, and they become friends with each other, and the friendships really matter. So that, you know, to kind of make girls' relationships with other girls central, I think is a really nice challenge to normative culture. But on the other hand, you know, there's a lot of ways in which they reproduce the demands of girls. So I think it's kind of a mixed bag. One of the interesting things that has happened with My Little Pony is that a whole bunch of boys have gotten interested in, and have kind of taken up My Little Pony as their thing. And so that's, you know, I think it just points to that My Little Pony has some possibilities for challenge to unhealthy demands made of girls and boys in our culture.
Adult men, I think, have taken it up, too. I mean, I've been hearing about bronies for a couple of years now.
Yep, that's exactly right. It's like sort of, you know, late teens and early 20s. I mean, I think there's probably some that go younger and older as well. But, yeah, they're bronies. There's a whole community. It's actually more of a online thing. So there aren't, I actually did some interviews with men who identify as bronies, and they aren't really interested in horses. Pardon me, they're actually more interested in the cartoon, the animated series of My Little Pony. And they, you know, so they watch it. They have conventions where it's a whole My Little Pony thing, and people dress up and bring merchandise and so on. But what I found in talking to the bronies that I spoke with was they actually are also offering a challenge to normative or normal demands of boys in our society, where boys are supposed to not have feelings. You know, boys are allowed to feel angry, but they aren't really allowed to cry, for example, right? I mean, those are some of the things we impress upon or socialize our boys for. And My Little Pony challenges that. The boys, I mean, it was actually made for little girls, preschool-age girls, but these young men kind of think, oh, this is an amazing animation, and it has a lot to offer, and they use it to develop a culture that's really a challenge to normal masculinity. As one brony told me, he said, you know, one of our slogans is, we're going to love and care for you, and then they use that, you know, the blank of you. We're gonna basically love you to death, in a sense. So instead of being about, you know, fighting or strength or adventure that boys are normally asked to have, these boys are about love and friendship.
We are talking to Jean O'Malley Holly about her book Horse Crazy. Here's a call from Lawrence in Medford. Welcome to the Exchange.
Good morning. I'm very interested in the conversation. I spent my whole life at the horse racetrack, to include in the womb, and I just retired last year from 25 years working at Portman Meadows.
Wow.
Racetrack. I know a lot of people have problems with horse racing, but in that life, I've met many great female jockeys, and they've become my friends. And when we're discussing the societal dynamic, the horse racetrack, unlike you mentioned, you left out competitive riding because of the cost. This is the opposite. You've got to earn, either in the early mornings as an exercise rider or as a jockey, every last bit. And Portland Meadows happens to have a lot, and they're now closed, of really top female riders and the trainers in Portland. Hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Hello? Yeah.
That's funny. But I would encourage you, because the stories are amazing, and I'm proud to say I've met personally Julie Crone, who's the only female ever to win one of the Triple Crown races.
Wow.
But you
can
probably
so
have a whole nother book.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So, all right, Lawrence, thank you so much for the call. Back to the call from Lawrence in Medford then about female jockeys. I've known a lot of them, and they had to work really hard to spend their time with horses and become professionals.
Absolutely, yeah. No, that was a really interesting call from Lawrence. And it, in all honesty, is not a world I know much about. It wasn't one of the, you know, places where there's horse culture that I actually studied. I didn't look at competitive riding, whether it be racing or jumping or showing, but I think that's very interesting. And from the little that I know, I'm sure Lawrence knows a million times more than me, that used to be a very male-dominated world, and women have worked their way into it, including not only as jockeys, but also as the ones who care for the horses. There, it's more and more common that the grooms be female. So that's very, very interesting. I wanted to mention, given the caller's, you know, smart feedback, I wanted to mention that horseback riding as like an Olympic sport where people are showing and jumping and competing, it has been since the middle of the 20th century the one sport that's gender equitable, that women and men compete against each other equally. And, you know, in little local shows around the United States, for example, we didn't have much money, so I wasn't able to show much, but I went to a couple of the little tiny local shows, and those do tend to be dominated largely by girls and women. But at the, you know, the international level of the Olympics, there are more and more men at that level. But it is a place where girls have competed, you know, with equality. And so it's interesting that even in horse racing, which had been dominated by men, Lawrence is, you know, letting us know that there are more and more women and girls there too.
So there's certainly a quantitative difference for people who, you know, grow up on farms and ranches around horses versus the girls who visit the stables, you know, a couple times a week or whatever. Did you find much of a qualitative difference? I don't know how much in your flock of 25 people you interviewed, people came from very different sorts of life backgrounds to end up with their love of horses.
Yeah, you know, that was interesting to me. I sort of expected to find more differences between my experience and the experience of, you know, what sometimes people call stable girls or barn rats. But it actually seemed pretty similar, that there was this, you know, obsession and passion for and with horses that just took up an enormous amount of, you know, their childhood and their dreams and their reading and their play in a very similar way across both groups. And another, you know, people in very rural areas like me and people who are in more urban areas hanging out at stables, there was a lot of similarity. I also found another similarity was that as those girls grew up and became women, the vast majority continued to be passionate about horses. And so they're even as adult women, when they talk to me about their horse experience now, there was a lot of similarity still. And one interesting way that women have sort of maintained their contact with horses is through volunteering. So kind of what they did as girls, you know, in urban areas in particular, where most of us can't afford to have a horse, hanging out at a stable is a way for a girl to just be around a horse. Well, the women also, you know, I can't really afford to have a horse. I live in New York City, but what I can do is go to a stable and volunteer. And so a lot of the women I spoke with are taking part in the rescue movement, which is a movement that kind of mirrors the movement for adopting dogs and cats through rescue from kill shelters. Well, there's a whole movement around horses as well, where largely women rescue them from being sent to slaughter. And you know, often the horses are not technically useful, right? Some of them can be sort of rehabilitated and turned into lesson horses, and others, you know, really can't be ridden anymore. But these women are devoted to horses, and they somehow manage to get the money together as a group. Somebody donates, they get it's a not-for-profit, they get some funding, and they have a couple of horses, and they volunteer and take care of them.
We've talked a couple times to a group that's just a few miles away from our station here that takes in horses that have been mistreated or poorly treated over their lives, and they're just coming to a place where they can live out their lives in relative peace and quiet.
That's exactly the kind of situation that I'm thinking of. Yeah, no, that's exactly it. And the other, I mean, it's amazing, really. It's like such a gift that these women give and others who are involved give to the horses. But I think it's also a recognition of the profoundness of that relationship that a lot of women have with horses. The other thing that people do sometimes, women that I spoke with do sometimes as a way to connect with horses, is that they volunteer at therapy places. So, for example, in New York City, the carriage horses that people see around Central Park are sometimes used on the weekends for horse therapy. And so one of the women I spoke with would go to the stable where they're kept and volunteer to help with the therapy, working with children with disability, and by doing that volunteering, she got to hang out around the horses. And a lot of the women I spoke with, it was really interesting that a lot of them actually don't really have any opportunities to ride, but for them the main thing is just to be around the horses, even if they can't afford to take lessons or ride. So that was, I thought, really touching. And that's something that came up again and again in the interviews, that as girls, the relationships they had with individual horses were a really important piece of why they were so passionate about horses.
Let's take another call. We have Robert in Fort Bragg, California, on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Gene O'Malley Holly, the author of Horse Crazy. Hi, Robert.
Hi, good morning. I live right across from a rodeo ground, so I constantly see the relationship that young ladies have with their horses. And I have a horse whisperer that lives on my farm who takes care of four horses. And I went down and painted the horses and interacted with them. And I was amazed how they helped me heal from my PTSD from Vietnam, and also gave me opportunities in my life to open doors. Like, one horse's name was Dollar. Honest to God, Dollar helped me make some money. I couldn't believe it. Within a half hour of working with Dollar, I got a nice check from a client that was very hard to deal with. But my horse whisperer friend is Beverly Smith, and she's doing a workshop September 12th at the Mendocino Center of Spiritual Living in Fort Bragg at the company store. And it would be so nice to get some young ladies to come and listen to her lecture series about horses. It was a whole secret world I knew nothing about, and I really appreciate this show that you're doing. It's just opening my heart and making me realize that there's so many things, so many gifts that the horses have. So I just really want to thank you.
All right. Thanks for that, Robert. Appreciate that. So September 12th at the Fort Bragg Company store. Thanks for the intelligence on that.
Thank you so much, Robert. That was really moving. I too have, from a different origin, the diagnosis of PTSD from the violence in my childhood. And I know that for me too, being around horses has been profoundly healing. There is, all the different things we've been talking about. There's the relationship itself, the physical contact with horses. I think it's a really powerful relationship. And certainly, as Robert indicated and as we talked about earlier, there's all kinds of ways in which I think horses can be, profoundly healing. I mean, if you think about somebody who's on the autism spectrum and has trouble understanding another person's emotional response to themselves, it's hard to know that if someone with autism might have trouble knowing the ways in which their behavior and emotional state is impacting on others. Those kind of social connections can be tough. And with horses are so amazingly attuned. As the earlier speaker, Ann, said, they're prey animals, so they really have a capacity to understand what's going on around them. And, you can come around a horse and not realize you're very sad, but the horse will know you're very sad. Or you may not realize you're irritated, but the horse will know. So horses help people, they reflect back that emotionality and help us to understand our own feelings as well as the impact our feelings have on others. And in the case of this, on the horse, it can be, I think, really centering and healing to develop a relationship like that.
So do we actually bond with horses? Is there oxytocin exchanged between humans and horses?
Absolutely. I think there's a profound bond in every one of the women I spoke with talked about how horses, when they were children, were not only their friends, but their best friends. One woman went on to list the horses she'd been in a relationship with, and she was a woman who used a wheelchair, and she had ridden as a child as a way to, as a therapy, to help her gain balance and strength. And she's, she may have been doing it for the therapy, but the relationship itself was also a piece of that. And she, the horses, as she said, still today, horses in her life are her best friends. There's a real relationship that happens. But it's also, as you pointed to, there's this element of oxytocin, which we're increasingly aware of, in our society, how that hormone plays a big role in our capacity to feel calm and good in the world, to relate with others. I mean, it's a hormone that's involved with pleasure. It's involved with orgasm. It's involved with the letdown of milk when women are breastfeeding. But it's also involved with when we connect with another. And I think if the connection is, you know, physical, like you're petting or grooming a horse, that brings out oxytocin. But there's some research that shows it can even be an emotional connection, right? You can see a picture of a horse or of your horse and have, you know, a release of oxytocin. So I think it literally physiologically becomes a healing response to phenomena like trauma.
Jean, when you go on in the book about the commercial peak of horsey girl culture in America, you know, Black Beauty and some of the other things that were just out there as consumer items, I did have to wonder about whether the mid-20th century desire of many boys to be cowboys, it ever even came close to horsey girls, or was it just about the guns and the fake horses?
If I'm understanding you correctly, the mid-20th century, I think there were more boys who were horse crazy, and certainly the literature and the consumer culture in the United States focused more on boys. I was really interested in that difference, that the women I spoke with had read a lot of the pony books or the horse books that were for children, like the Black Stallion series by Walter Farley, and there are, you know, dozens, really, that he's written, or he's passed away now, but that series was very male-focused. All of the characters in the novels were men or boys, all of the horses. Literally out of his, I think, 20 books that were focused on the Black Stallion, this one particular horse, there was one book that had a girl enter in and be an active character for a period of time, and one book where there was a mare, a female horse, at the center of the story. Otherwise, it was all men and all stallions or geldings, male horses. The women I spoke with said, well, we read those books, and I said, did you fall in love with the male characters? And they said, oh, no. One woman, as she put it, she said, I was Alec. I was the boy. I was the one who could bond with this Black Stallion. It's taken a while in the U.S. for the shift of pony book literature and paraphernalia to really turn and, you know, focus on girls and women. But in the United Kingdom, there was another phenomenon, the pony book literature there from the 30s really focused on girls, and that literature had a very feminist element to it, where the girls in the stories were brave and they rescued people, and they were the, like one girl, Jean, in this book by series by Christine Pulling Thompson, Jean rescued her older brother more than once. She was the one who was brave and strong, and, you know, she was the hero. And that whole literature from the 30s into the 70s in the United Kingdom had a real girl-centric focus.
So let's wrap things up here. Do the feelings from the girl-horse relationship stay, or do many horsey girls end up retreating to these norms we talked about?
My sense is that they stay, that it's that the girl, you know, they really shape, for me certainly, who I became in the world and the sense of strength and safety and security I had. I think it's had a permanent impact on me, and that's what the women I spoke with said about themselves. And, I mean, the other thing that seems to stay is, out of the 20, I spoke with a lot of people, but I interviewed among that larger group, I interviewed 25 women who had been horse crazy as girls, and those 25 women, only four were no longer, you know, focused on, in a passionate way, horses. Only four. Out of 25,
wow.
21 were still very actively horse crazy. So the relationship and the love stays, but I also think the impact it has on our lives stays in ways that are really profound and wonderful.
So talk about intergenerational love then. Do horsey girls grow up and raise horsey girls of their own?
That's what it seemed to be. I mean, a lot of girls come to it without having a horse crazy person in their family. That was the case for me and for my aunt and for many people I know, that I was just, I found horse craziness on my own. But certainly there were a number of the women I spoke with, for sure, who said, oh, and now my daughter's horse crazy, or my niece, you know, I've connected my niece to horses. And so I think it does become multi-generational, absolutely.
We have to go in just a couple of seconds here. I noticed that when Snipaway, your quarter horse, died, you stayed away from horses for a very long time, but you got back on them. You're back with horses now. How do you get your horse fixed living in New York City?
I go to a stable and I hang out and I periodically pay for a lesson. So I kind of do what those girls used to do as well. It's a stable called Gallup, where there's a lot of work being done with people with disability, and they actually rescue horses as well. They use rescued horses in their lessons. So that's where I get my fix.
All right. Yeah. It's a personal story, but it's also a much broader sociological story, which you would expect from Jean O'Malley-Holly, who is a sociology professor at the City University of New York. The book is Horse Crazy, Girls and the Lives of Horses. Jean, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.